This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning in. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's B-O-B-B-Y-K-K-R-A-F-T, and you are listening to episode 32. When you get a chance, if you like what you hear, it would be awesome if you rate and review the podcast on iTunes. This really does help because I would love the feedback. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I spoke with Jason Hirschman, a private investor who goes by the handle at 8Track on the Microcap Club and at 8Track18 on Twitter. I met Jason during a networking party at the Microcap Club Leadership Summit, and we were going over the company presentations we had just seen that day. I really enjoyed hearing his thoughts and how he assessed management that presented their companies that day. The one thing I took away from our conversation was that while it's important to put together your investing thesis, you know, what works and what doesn't, it's also really important to question that very same investing thesis. The goal for this episode is to learn about Jason's investing strategy, how he questions management, and his advice for new microcap investors. Thank you again for tuning in to episode 32 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with Jason Hirschman, but first, a word from our sponsor.
Are you a microcap investor? Would you like to meet with management? If you're a loyal listener to the Planet Microcap Podcast, you know the importance of qualitative due diligence. The producers of this podcast invite you to attend the Planet Microcap Showcase, a microcap investor conference on April 26th through April 28th at Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. The Planet Microcap Showcase is 2.5 days of company presentations, networking opportunities, and private one-on-one meetings with company management of undiscovered and well-known microcap companies. So join us at the Planet Microcap Showcase, April 26th through April 28th, at the Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino in Las Vegas to network with like-minded microcap investors and find new opportunities. For more information, go to www.planetmicrocapshowcase.com and register now to reserve your spot. Look forward to seeing you all there.
For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I have Jason Hirschman on the program. He is a private investor and member of the Microcap Club. Jason, welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, West Coast Robert Kraft.
You know what? The West Coast Robert Kraft welcomes you with open arms. How you doing?
Well, thank you.
All right. So let's get right into this. As I ask everybody to start off, what is your background?
Okay. Well, let me give you an answer, Robert, appropriate to your audience. I was born one third of the way through the 1973-74 bear market, which tagged the Dow Jones for more than a 40% loss. So really auspicious start for me. I graduated from University of Chicago in 1995 with a degree in economics, did a little bit of consulting. Honestly, I don't do well with bureaucracy. I'm not a yes man. I'm not a paper pusher. I'm not a sock puppet, okay? I am not a sock puppet. So, I soon joined the family business. I had worked there many summers and have stayed there ever since. Don't underestimate the value of nepotism and not being a total doofus. It's a powerful combination.
Hey, I'm in a family business, so you know what? I hear you.
And you're not a total doofus, too. So there you go.
I hope not.
And working in a small family business, honestly, has really helped my investing. You know, it's given me the opportunity to be involved in everything from product design to inventory control to sales and marketing to patent litigation, both as a plaintiff and a defendant. It's also taught me to seek out investments that, quite honestly, are better businesses than the one I manage on a daily basis. Something with a superior business model and superior management, which is honestly probably not me. So that's the 30-second answer.
All right. And then how did you start investing in microcap stocks?
Okay, well let me just – unfortunately, I wasn't smart enough or lucky enough to start as a microcap investor. So, you know, back in 95 and 96, you got to remember the stock market was booming, right? And I swear to you, the first week I bought stock, Mr. Market snuck into my bedroom, took out the biggest Sharpie marker he had, and wrote bag holder across my forehead as I slept. In fact, I started as a technical chartist, you know, all those doji stars, MACD, moving averages, etc. First four stocks I bought, Mexican Trucking ADR, a regional subprime auto lender. I shorted Intel. I even bought, it was a company called Airborne Freight, which was a poor man's UPS. I did it all on the basis of good-looking charts, and I can tell you the results, they were not good, not good at all. So I was humiliated right away as an investor. But really, thanks goodness for Roger Lowenstein, because in 1995, you know, he published Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist. And Peter Lynch actually spoke at my high school graduation. So I quickly moved to Lynch, Buffett, and a famous Vanguard investor at the time named John Neff, all fundamentals guys. And, you know, and this made sense to me when I opened my eyes because of my experience growing up in a family business. So that's how I got into investing. Now, this is a microcap show, so I'm going to segue straight into microcaps then. So, you know, one trait that I picked up both from meeting Peter Lynch and from an investor friend of mine, is when possible, you follow multiple stocks in an area. So I used to follow publicly traded asset managers, which led me to Diamond Hill Investment Group in late 2002. And DHIL, that was my introduction to microcaps. Now the company is closer to a $700 million market cap. But back when I was buying it in December 2002, early 2003, the market cap was less than $10 million. Probably closer to $8 million or so. You know, at the time, the assets under management were less than $200 million. Now it's more than $15 billion. And I really liked the company, Robert. I mean, I emailed and I communicated with management a few times. Even in mid-2003, I even showed up at their annual meeting in Ohio. And I think I was actually the only outside investor that year, except for a few, you know, local cronies. So anyway, you know, when we talk about specific microcap stocks and learning experiences, I'll tell you how I made a BMW or so from Diamond Hill instead of a few million dollars. It was really, you know, it was early success, but also a big mistake at the same time. Mm-hmm.
So what's your criteria now? You know, you've been doing this now for a little bit. So are some of the things that you look for when you're assessing a microcap company for potential investment?
Sure. Yeah, I'm not a good trader. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the illiquidity of microcaps makes it difficult for me to even swing trade effectively. So I really do approach microcaps as potential long-term investments. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for a microcap firm which is either profitable or at the cusp of profitability, because I don't want to be stuck in a company that is always one more secondary round away from that final equity dilution, you know, and it always seems to happen. You know, this is the last round. Now, this is going to be the last round. So I don't want to get into a situation like that. I want a firm that I believe will maintain a good return on equity, you know, something in the range of 20 to 30% for hopefully many years, which means I'm always looking for a firm that has a runway for high-value reinvestment. It's not a one-trick pony. You know, I want good management, but really, you know, to be honest with you, you know, what is good management? You know, most investors, including myself, I think, they see a successful firm, and we assume it's good management. A poorly performing firm, we assume just bad management. And it's really not necessarily true. You know, some industries are just tougher than others. You know, from what I know, like Jennifer Q at Jones Soda is a strong manager, but she's in a really tough business for tiny firms, you know, sugar water. So is she a good manager? Is she a bad manager? It's really tough to say.
Hey, for full disclosure, are you a shareholder or no?
I'm not a shareholder in Jones Soda. So, and thanks for reminding me for that. So, you know, it is tough to say, you know, tell good, but it's easier to discern honesty. There's no one thing for, you know, no go for honesty. But you want to know, does management shy away from overpromotion or overpromising? Is the pay reasonable and stock options reasonable when you communicate with them? Are they superheroes in their own imaginary world, or are they more modest? So I hope that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. No, it seems like you really truly look at the fundamentals, and you know, management, for unlike with some of my other guests, you know, isn't as important, because it's really tough to quantify. I mean, how do you quantify what is a good or bad manager, like you said? You know, so if you had to surmise, like, what would be your microcap investing thesis then? Thesis in the sense of, like, kind of how I wrapped it up just there, you know, like, if you had, like, a couple things that you would wrap up your thesis? Like, if you were just looking around at your, like, it just checked off all these boxes, what would those boxes be? Like, just boom, boom, boom. What would they be?
Sure. You know, well, I think one thing we haven't talked about is valuation, right? Mm-hmm. I'm looking for something with a high return on equity, but I'm also looking for something with probably a low price to book at the same time. You're looking for some team that you will believe is at least good management. It has to be honest management, okay? And you're looking for, like I said, you don't want it to be that one-trick pony. Mm. It's got to have a business that they can grow into a larger platform or add on some additional products. Because, there's a lot of companies out there that has, there's that one product that suddenly, takes off. It's, one drug, some pet rock that's selling really remarkably well. But, after a few quarters of growth, then, frankly, there's nowhere else for it to go, and then the stock will drop and the company will probably just stagnate. So a lot of it's just avoiding, companies that don't fit that.
Mm-hmm. And I think, the one thing I think that I really wanted to hit on in this interview, and we've brought it up already, and we're going to go down this road, okay? And I hope you're going to follow me. and that has to do with assessing good and bad management. So what are the types of things that you will ask management when you're starting to do your follow-up due diligence after it's kind of checked all the fundamental boxes?
Honestly, I don't have set questions. I know some people have there's a list of questions that are asking. With microcaps, all these companies are so sort of unique or different or special, you almost have to design your own set of questions to that specific company. Mm-hmm. Figure out what you know and what you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. And also, when you're communicating with management, I have a reputation for sometimes being asking some tough questions or being a little blunt, but you have to gauge the personality of the manager with whom you're conversing. You have to design a bespoke list of questions for that individual and company. Especially in that one-on-one first conversation on the telephone, you don't have to push it. I don't think I'm directly answering your questions, but I do have a few goals when speaking with management.
Cool. Yeah, please.
There are areas of the business or balance sheet I simply don't know enough. And a lot of times, management will only open the kimono just a little bit more with each conversation, So sometimes you need multiple conversations just to find out things about management. So you don't want to tick them off so they don't want to speak to you again, right? And one of the differences that I do, probably than maybe other investors, is I want to give the manager an opportunity to lie to me, which may sound a little strange, or distort things to me. Sometimes I'll ask a question someone else has asked and see if I get a different answer. Sometimes I'll ask a question in a leading way, but leading away from what I want to hear. And I'm really hoping that the manager is going to say, I'm sorry, but that's not our strategy, or I don't think so, or I think you're wrong. If you only ask questions that you want, yes as the answer, and the manager knows this, then if he gives you a yes, is he telling you the truth or just telling you what you want to hear? And if you want, I'll give you an example, because I think maybe I'm just talking in like theoretical terms and not concretely enough.
No, we love examples here.
Okay, great. a couple of years ago, before the Microcap Club, they didn't call it a summit at the time, but basically they had the meeting in Detroit. Some shareholders of Bioscience met at Bioscience headquarters, and Bioscience is a specialty pharma firm that trades on the TMX Venture Exchange. It basically in-licensed drugs from other companies for the Canadian market. Probably a lot of your listeners may be very familiar with them and may even be shareholders. Well, a few of us met with management at the time, and basically during a couple years ago, Valeant was hot, Concordia was hot, all these companies borrowing money, buying drugs. And meanwhile, Rene, the CEO of Bioscience, he's really not the kind of guy who easily borrows money. So I was, joking early on that because Concordia had just made a deal. It's like, come on, Rene, you want to play in their same league. Borrow some money, grow. And frankly, that's not what I wanted him to do, right? I want him to have a fantastic return on equity. They shouldn't borrow money. They should keep their balance sheet clean. Mm-hmm. But I was sort of leading him on, egging him on. He said, come on, borrow some money. Don't you want to play with the big boys? And he basically looked at me in front of everybody else like, are you even a shareholder? And that was the first time I met him, and actually took me aback a little bit because it's a little embarrassing to, to hear that in front of everybody else. But honestly, it was exactly the answer that I wanted to hear, right? Mm-hmm. You want to give an opportunity. I didn't want him to hear, just to placate me, to say, you know what, maybe that is a good idea. Or maybe what, you know what, we'll have to consider that. Or if Concordia and Valiant continue to do those things, we'll have to move in that direction too. You know, I was glad he pushed back. So you want to give sometimes the CEO an opportunity to push back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, you know, you don't want to tick off the guy. And you always want to end the conversation or the meeting, you know, on a positive note, right? People remember the end, how it ends. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you do make things a little tough, a little rough, and hopefully not too much, you know, try and repair things before you end your conversation. You know, don't let the guy just walk away and say, "Who is that?" You know.
Mm-hmm. What's an example of when you? I guess people might want to know. Well, how do you tick a guy off then? You know, what. I mean, I guess it can be pretty easy if you know, I've seen people, not know the company as well as they should. You know, they have to say it again, you know, the story again over and over. But like with your strategy, you know, like, do you have an example of how you have ticked off a guy or woman?
We even talked a little bit I'm really plugging MicroCap Club over here today, but summit in Chicago, right? There's a meet with a number of different companies. About six or seven or so investors, and then you meet with the management. You go around and around every 15 minutes. You move to another table. So one of the tables I went with was Socket Mobile, right? And they make this little handheld scanner product. They really got into the Apple market.
And full disclosure, you're a shareholder or
not a shareholder of Socket Mobile. I am a shareholder of BioScience.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, continue.
Okay, sure. And the thing is like, I just didn't understand why someone else can't replicate this scanner for a lower price, you know? And so I was pushing the guy a little bit. He says, "I don't understand what's so special about your scanner. You know, why isn't someone going to come in and simply undercut you? You know, what makes your scanner so great? I mean, it doesn't look like whatever advantage you had in the Apple market is going to continue, because as that Apple market has now grown, other players will come in." And I take the guy, I mean, he was a little tired already. And he basically just looked at me and said, "You know why? Because," and this, they don't sell directly to the end user. Let me rephrase that. The end user purchases the scanner, but it's the software producer who typically requires a Socket Mobile scanner into their program that the end user is using, right? Mm-hmm. You know, therefore, the Socket Mobile CEO told me, he said, "Because, you know, these software designers, you know, they don't give a shit about the price. You know, they don't give a shit, right? They're looking for something that makes their life easier, that's allowed them to write their software more effectively and efficiently. You know, and frankly, it got to the core of it. Frankly, the guy was ticked off, though, right? So, you know, and I was basically, you didn't have to step back. You had to say, you know what, that's all I wanted to know. You know, thank you very much. And I appreciate it. And, you know, and then you don't press any more buttons. It's got a little bit of a you got a sense of situation there.
But what I think is important to note here, and the lesson learned, is that you don't have to be the own 2% of the company's outstanding share, you know, or have a huge position to feel like you can't ask these hard-hitting questions. Because I feel like sometimes, you know, you may want to, but you might be a little worried that this guy's just going, you're just another, you know, you have a small position, ask me these questions. You know, like, I think that's a really good point, you know, because not all the stock that you might own in your own portfolio you have huge holdings in, you know?
Yeah, right? I totally agree with you, Robert. And you know, and I think it's probably, in most situations, you at least want to show the person you're talking to a bit of respect,
of course,
by knowing his business, you know, by knowing his industry, right? Mm-hmm. Want to weave, you know, to the extent you can, some difficult questions with some easier questions, mm-hmm. or at least display that you're being respectful. But you can't shy away from those difficult questions. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of investors, you know, quite frankly, you know, they don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to appear like a jerk, but in essence, even if you make a mistake, even if you go a little too far, you can always walk it back. Mm-hmm. You can always apologize. You can always say, you know what, I phrased that incorrectly, or I don't think I really meant it that way. And you know, most people are forgiving. You know, it's not like they're going to, like, throw a bottle of water in your face or hang up on you. So, you know, the key is you know, you can really push things probably a little further than most people, you know, most people do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. Mm-hmm.
You know, I also want to go back to another point that you made that was really interesting. And what I'm curious about knowing a little bit more of, you said you'd like to ask some questions regarding the balance sheet a little bit more, and you know, because you just want some elaboration to understand certain things that may not be totally clear from the outset. You know, what are some examples of those questions that you might ask that maybe some of our investor audience may not even think to ask?
Sure. I mean, again, it goes back to...
I know it's sector by sector, company by company dependent for sure, but, you know, like...
Frankly, what you have to do, and I think a lot of investors, particularly new investors, they look at the income statement, right? Right. Everybody loves to look at the income statement. How much mm-hmm. the revenue is growing? How much, you know, is the income growing or what, hopefully there is income, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, but it's also important to look at the balance sheet and understand how they work together, right? But... You know, really, what you have to do as an investor, you just have to go line by line and look at the number. If the number is going up very rapidly and you don't know what that number is, or you don't know why it's going up rapidly, you got to find out. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, just yesterday, Expel, which manufactures paint protection film, it's a Nevada corporation based out of San Antonio, but trades on the TMX Venture Exchange in Canada. And full disclosure, I am a shareholder. They just reported their third quarter numbers. And for the first time, they broke out some warranty expenses. And now this is an income statement number, but in essence, it's still the same thing. You know, they had never broken it out before, and it had gone up, like, dramatically more than the previous year. So, you know, conference call, I get on the phone, I ask them a question. You know, why are these numbers going up so much? And what I had thought going into this, you know, just reading that warranty expense before I asked the question, I thought, well, the reason why it's going up so dramatically is that they give a 10-year warranty, and, you know, there's all these additional cars out there with the warranty, and, you know, in the latter years, people are utilizing the warranty, and that's why it's going up, greater than the rate of sales increase. And, you know, what Ryan Pape answered, who's the CEO, is what, no, the reason is that a lot of these warranty expenses are during the installation moment. You know, the installer is installing it incorrectly, and therefore, you know, makes a warranty claim. And at the same time, Expel has just changed a little bit their formula for paint protection film, so he probably doesn't install exactly the same. And in essence, he was suggesting that the reason for the increase is because of, you know, these changes which are going along in the film, and that they won't be increasing at the same rate. Now, if I didn't ask that question or someone else didn't ask that question on the conference call, I can tell you I would have assumed dramatically the wrong reason why those warranty expenses were going up. Mm. And frankly, you know, if you start extrapolating out, you start saying, you know, well, geez, you know, this is a small number. These can become big things when they grow at 100% rate. So, you know, it's important. If you don't understand something, you got to figure out why. I mean, these microcaps are illiquid. You know, you've got to know practically everything you can know before you get into them or before you make it a big position. Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing prior to our talk here is when we met in Chicago is I remember you talking about how you love doing your best to disprove your own thesis. You know, so what does that mean?
Well, that means is that, you know, you don't want, you know, and let me just contrast what I think a lot of other people do and mm-hmm. why I think it's a mistake. Mm-hmm. I think what a lot of investors do, and not just microcap investors, you know, they do their due diligence before they get into the stock. Mm-hmm. And then once they make it a large decision, they've almost become cheerleaders for the company they're invested in, mm-hmm. right? Which, frankly, I think is a big mistake because you really want to keep doing the examination, keep finding things wrong with the thesis after you've invested it, and particularly if it's a large position. Because if it's a small position, even if something goes wrong, you're not going to be hurt. But if it's a large position and you don't understand the stock, it can really kill you. You know, if you don't understand the risks or if you miss certain risks that perhaps you should have caught. So you know, what I like to do is I'm, particularly with the larger companies, you're always looking for the, for stuff that's wrong with it. You always got to be coming up with new ways that, you know, something could go wrong. And, you know, it always amazes me, even when I go on boards, or like MicroCap Club even, you know, people give likes for, you know, like the shareholder who owns it will like a comment that's positive. That's just, and it's not like it's really ingenious positive or like it's really intriguing or something new, but it's just a positive rah-rah comment. You know, really what you want to do is you want to like those comments that are negative, that are smartly negative, because that's actually giving you as a shareholder some new information, you know, a new way that you not you may be positioned incorrectly. So, you know, you constantly have to look for things which are wrong with your company. Mm-hmm. And I've made that mistake. I mean, that was a tough lesson to learn. And if you want to about it, you know, right now I can tell you about EVCI Career Colleges, because that really taught me, you know, why I need to just keep doubting my own investments.
I was going to say, you read my mind from the next question. So, you know, I'm going to ask you formally. Here we go. This is the formal question asked moment. You know, so are there any microcap investing experiences that taught you a valuable lesson and shaped your strategy?
Sure. You know, let me open with this. I'll open up with a Will Rogers quote. You know, and Will Rogers once said, "There are three kinds of men: the one that learns by reading, the few who learn by observation, the rest of them have to pee on the electric fence for themselves." Okay, so peeing on an electric fence, it hurts, but you know, hopefully, it teaches you a lesson. And you know, I really, you know, man, EVCI Career College has taught me a lesson. EVCI Career Colleges was a tiny microcap for-profit education firm, less than $50 million market cap or so, with a school in New York City called Interborough. And it eventually got shut down by New York State because of too many of its students were not properly educated. Now, today it's easy to throw shade at for-profit schools, but back in the mid-2000s, you know, they were growing nicely and seen as like a society-friendly alternative to stodgy old colleges and universities. So mistake number one for me was I fell in love with, you know, quote unquote, the future, which you don't want to do. You know, you don't want to fall in love and just think, you know, my stock represents the future, or you know, software as a service, you know, represents the future, and just, you know, give your company a pass simply because it's in a hot industry, right? So that's mistake number one that I did. Mistake number two, EVCI had a special model that took a combination of a Pell Grant and for low-income students and New York State funding for education, and used it to almost completely cover tuition for high school dropouts who passed a college acceptance test, right? So these are high school dropouts that passed a college acceptance test now get to go to college. So it seemed like it was doing a good thing for society and for many students. I even contacted a few of them. They were optimistic. But really, again, you always have to look for doubt. You always have to look for errors in your thinking. You know, does it really make sense that large numbers of high school dropouts in low-income areas, often with other socioeconomic problems, that a business could be designed to turn these kids into successful college students for just a few thousand dollars a year? You know, so I didn't rip my thesis apart, Robert, even particularly after I bought it, because I was so in love with the you know, this for-profit school area. I was in love, and I thought this is a company doing a wonderful thing. So I didn't give it the scrutiny it really deserved. Now, mistake number three is a real whopper, and it sounds so stupid today, but I reached out to management because, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. I asked a tough question, but the problem is I asked a tough question, and I wanted to be convinced that I was wrong. You know, I want my due diligence to be, like, worthwhile. So, you know, then what is the value of the tough question? So this was the issue, and you're going to laugh. One of the trustees of this firm, or of Interborough, maybe their school, was the president of a correspondence school operating out of Liberia. Now, that just should scare you away right then and there, right? Yeah. President of a correspondence school operating out of Liberia as a trustee. Now, I told the CEO that this looks terrible, and he replied to me that the trustee had gone through a difficult divorce, needed money, yada, yada, yada. You know, I wanted to validate all the work I put into EVCI. But now, you know, I know that you do all the work sometimes just not to make the investment, or you do the work to get out sooner rather than later, you know? So, you know, I peed on the electric fence, and I learned, you know, and hopefully you change your mindset. And that particular episode really taught me that you, at every step of the way, you got to create doubt, you know, in your mind that you're invested the proper way. You know, you got to look for the cracks. I'm not the first person to say it, but you got to have strong opinions, but strong opinions held like loosely. So you got to be open to change. And it's very tough for that. I mean, because particularly when you make when you're making it a large position, because you feel very strongly about something. But you got to be able to have those strong opinions, but you've got to be open to changing your mind. If you can't do that, it's probably too big a position.
So, Jason, I have to ask, you know, and you can answer this if you want or not. Totally cool. What was, like, the funniest experience where you were doubting your thesis, you wanted to find the cracks, and you asked that one question to management, and they had a great response? I mean, you said the BioSign one earlier, but what was, like, really just, you'll never forget it? Like, it was just fun. Like, it always stands out in your mind.
You know what? I'm afraid it's an excellent question, but I really don't. I don't have one that really stood out in my mind. I mean, there are interesting people I've talked to. Mm-hmm. I mean, and this is one of the other benefits of. And I'm just going to take your question. I'm going to segue it in a slightly different direction.
Okay.
You know, one of the other things that you always want to do, right, as an investor, is that you want to work on your circle of competence, and you want to work on your the friends that you can work with, right? I call it like friends with financial benefits. And as you've interviewed Chip before, mm-hmm. And discussed about Canadian stocks, and I had mentioned a small firm up in Canada called Less Mess Storage, which actually was also, again, on the Canadian Venture Exchange. They had a small number of self-storage locations in Poland and the Czech Republic, of all places, and it traded on up in Canada.
And full disclosure, are you a shareholder or not?
Well, frankly, it was taken over.
Oh, okay.
Taken over. Mm-hmm. So I was a shareholder, and then it got taken over very quickly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mentioned it to Chip, and I had owned a little bit of a position. And he happened to be at a conference, you know, talking to one of these IR guys, and after they mentioned, you know, they talked about the firm that they originally intended talking to, the guy mentioned he was also the IR guy for Less Mess. You know, and then that got Chip, because he remembered that I had mentioned it to him. He talked to the guy. You know, sooner rather than later, we had a conference call set up with management. And the funny thing is that you ask, well, you say you're going to turn these self-storage units, you're going to get the utilization up. But, you know, how do we really know that they were so poorly run? I mean, it's so easy to say they were poorly run, but... You know, how do we really know? And the CEO was a graduate of Cambridge. You can imagine the proper British accent that he had. He tells us that, well, you know, under the old management, some of these storage units were operated by what he referred to as ladies of the night for their activities. Which is a very funny way of saying prostitutes, at least when you say it as a British accent. Mm-hmm. If a self-storage unit is being run and being leasing units to prostitutes, it's probably not that well run. Mm-hmm. So, you know, little things like that actually, you know, sometimes can inform you more than just someone, you know, handing you and saying they're going to increase capacity utilization from 77 up to 84%, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're going to get rid of the ladies of the night. Well, you know, that's all I need to know.
So that you actually provided some pretty good advice in there for new microcap investors. I mean, is there anything else that you think, you know, some of my audience maybe should know?
Well, let's see, some other things that your audience should know. Are we talking like new investors or experienced investors, or just
if you'd like to address both? I mean, you just talked about like knowing your core competency, you know, maybe starting out with that.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a new investor, and you're going to run into experienced microcap investors who really concentrate, you know, who put 40, 50, 60% of their portfolio in a single stock. Mm-hmm. And I really don't think that's a good idea, particularly for new investors. Mm-hmm. Particularly, it seems to be the investors who really concentrate tremendously in age, and investor age is like inversely proportionate. You have like 20-year-olds with always put like 80% of their portfolio in one stock. I don't understand why they do it. I understand, you know, everyone wants to be a full-time investor before they're 40, but it really, you know, a little bit of prunes, a little bit of diversification is probably the right way to go. Mm-hmm. But let's end it with saying with this. You know, one time I was at a WESCO meeting in Pasadena when, you know, Charlie Munger used to preside over those meetings, and he told the crowd that young investors always come up to him and want to emulate his success, but do it even faster. And he remarked that perhaps a crucial ingredient of his success is doing things slowly. So, you know, you don't have to make a gazillion dollars on your first few microcaps. It's not the end of the world to leave a little money on the table. You know, prudence and conservative behavior, I mean, they're boring words, but they're good words. So that's just my advice to, like, newbie microcap investors.
And do you have any resources that you would recommend for new microcap investors to get familiar with?
Well, I think, you know, everybody knows the Mungers of the world, and everybody knows the Buffetts. A lot of investors know Michael. I always butcher his last name, like Mabousin or Mabousin, Mabousin. Mm-hmm. He writes, and you can find, like, you know, Competitive Advantage Period, another report called The Fat Tails That Wagged the Dog, which is about return on invested capital. He wrote a book called Expectations Investing. Mm-hmm. And frankly, besides the giants like Lynch and Munger and Buffett, I really took the most out of Michael Mabousin. I would suggest that anybody reads his stuff mm-hmm. backwards and forwards.
And again, Jason, where can people follow you on Twitter and on the Microcap Club?
Well, you can just eight track, but not with the number eight track 18 on Twitter, or I just post as 8-Track on Microcap Club. So that's the easiest way to find me.
Jason, thank you so much for joining me today on the Planet Microcap podcast, and I look forward to speaking again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you all for tuning in to the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, Jason, again for coming on to the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast, go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap Podcast. Stay tuned for the next Planet Microcap Podcast, where we'll have our next guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of stocknewsnow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap Podcast. Have a very happy Thanksgiving, everyone.